Thank you for listening to the SSPX podcast, delivering talks, lectures, and the spoken word from across the English-speaking world. In this episode, we continue our series, Questions with Father. We're speaking again with Father Paul Robinson, professor at Holy Cross Seminary in Goulburn, Australia. In this episode, we have improved the audio quality quite substantially from our first episode with Father Robinson, and we hope you will enjoy both the content and hearing from Father in this improved quality. Today, we spoke with Father about maintaining a spirit of prayer, almost a monastic internal spirit of prayer for those of us who are working and in the world. Secondly, we spoke with Father on somewhat of a related topic, that of how to balance work and life for those who have a family and are working. And the final question from our listeners, how is the Society of St. Pius X consistent when it comes to the modern canonizations in regards to previous saints, such as Maximilian Kolbe, Padre Pio, and more, compared with canonizations of John Paul II, the upcoming canonization of Paul VI, and more? As always, if you have questions that you would like answered on a future podcast, either with Father Robinson or any of our other priests, please feel free to submit them either on our Facebook page or through our website. We'll continue to ask the questions, and the fathers of the Society of St. Pius X have graciously agreed to give us the answers. We continue now with Father Robinson.
Right, Father, thank you for joining us again. How are things going with you this week?
They're going well, Andrew. We just finished a part of our term, and now we have a week coming up of a break, which was long looked for and will be well appreciated.
Good to hear. Well, getting back into the questions that we have from Facebook and from our website and people emailing in, wanted to move on to another topic. One of the questions was, how does one keep a spirit of prayer in a secular world, and especially for those who may be working, like people who are in the world in that sense?
Well, the first thing with regards to that question I would like to emphasize, Andrew, is that the spiritual life is definitely a life. We have to see it as analogous to the biological life that we have. We know that with our biological life, we obviously have to take care of our body on a regular basis. It has to be a consistent thing. We have to eat three meals a day. We have to sleep so many hours a day. And if we don't do that, our biological health just breaks down. And something similar applies for the spiritual life. If we're going to do something in the spiritual life, it has to be very regular. There has to be a certain stability. There has to be a certain discipline if we're going to have any long-term effects. What a priest tends to see, not only in the faithful, but also this temptation in himself, is that we can get a little bit discouraged when we don't see certain results in the spiritual life. Often the spiritual life is not very tangible, so people get discouraged. They might have a regular prayer routine for a while, and then they abandon it because they can't measure their progress. But we, especially in that life, we have to try to do something consistently every day. So I just really want to emphasize that. Then as far as how you would construct your spiritual life when you decided, oh, I want to do something regular. I really want to have a long-term goal for my spiritual life. I want to make progress. I think it's really important to be able to have solid spiritual acts, I would say, each day. At least sometime during the day, we are able to find a time, we're able to find a place where we can really recollect ourselves, we can detach ourselves, and we can get into this spirit where we feel like we're actually connecting with God, where the distractions settle down, sort of the boiling in our head settles down, and we're really speaking to God. Our prayer is real. It's not just sort of mumbling or what have you. I think that's extremely important goal, even if we only do it for 5 minutes.
Right.
I think that's a good accomplishment.
So when you say something tangible, I mean, it could be, I mean, I know this sounds silly when we're talking about, you know, a spiritual life, you know, and getting away from the world, but even setting a reminder on a calendar, on your calendar or on your phone or something like that to just get away and, you know, again, sounds silly, but set a reminder on your phone to get away from your phone for a little while, or to get a step away from the computer. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, or more of a concrete, you know, we're going to do the family rosary, or maybe option C, all of the above?
Yeah, well, I definitely think it's all of the above. I think what I'm speaking about is a general disposition that I want to find some time during the day in which I can detach myself from all technology. I can detach myself from my work or whatever it is I'm doing, and I can find sort of a quiet place and really reach into the interior of my soul and recollect myself. And have intimate time with God, and apply myself deeply to spiritual activity. And it's a prerequisite that it be a set time. I think that's a great help. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, most of us have a routine. Our days are very similar one to another. So it's just a question of saying what time. And in fact, I would think that the morning is often the best. For instance, can I get up 10 minutes earlier than I would normally, and perhaps brush my teeth, take a shower, what have you, and then use 10 minutes to just do some meditation or do some contemplative spiritual reading or what have you. I think, you know, 10 minutes is not much.
Right.
But those 10 minutes would be extremely effective, I think, if they're done every single day over a long period.
Speaking of prayer and going a little bit off topic here, I know we're talking about, you know, keeping a spirit of prayer and you know, the interior life. But as far as prayer in general, you know, I think many times we think of prayer as, all right, I need to, you know, get out the Imitation of Christ, or I need to get out the, you know, Christian Warfare, or look up this meditation, or look at this. You know, those are obviously great, and not to disparage those by any means. But is there equal, and I guess I'm asking, you know, equal value, but and I know you can't really say that, but is there equal value to just sitting or kneeling or standing or walking and having a mental prayer, I guess, conversation? I know that sounds really wishy-washy, but is that just as valuable? Is there time to be set aside for that kind of prayer as compared to more formal prayer?
Absolutely. I think the spirit of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius are a good guide in this question that you're asking, Andrew, which is an excellent question, because it sort of leads us towards the discussion of the art of prayer, the fact that prayer is an art to a certain degree. And in all arts, there has to be flexibility. So when probably a lot of our listeners would have gone on Ignatian retreats, and mm-hmm. They will find in there that St. Ignatius is trying to do a lot of things to sort of dispose us for that conversation with God. He kind of puts up this massive scaffolding in order to get us into this state where we are having a conversation with God, where it is real. So he says, you know, if it helps you to kneel down, kneel down. If it helps you to sit down, sit down. If it helps you to pull your blinds and make it dark in your room, do that. Mm-hmm. If it helps you to have light in your room, do that. So whatever is going to put you in that state of recollection, then those are the things you should do. In order to reach the final end, the main purpose of the meditative prayer, which is this effective conversation with God, or even just a contemplation, a looking at God in wonder, in worship.
And like you said at the beginning, this is not something that is achieved overnight. This is something that takes practice, you know, like any skill or any other, any other skill that we have in life. It takes practice. It takes doing it every day, you know, multiple times a day, in order to really achieve not a perfection, but to strive for that perfection in a spiritual life. Would that be right?
That's absolutely correct, Andrew. I sometimes tell people don't expect prayer to be easy. Sometimes people feel bad because they're saying, "Wow, I find it difficult to pray," or "I find it difficult even to motivate myself to pray." Sometimes people will say, mm-hmm. and we should not be surprised at that, because prayer is a difficult thing. It is a spiritual act. We are both body and soul, so we find it difficult to raise ourselves above our human condition, in a certain sense, to rise ourselves above this earth in order to look at our Creator. But the thing is, if we apply ourselves on a regular basis to this effort of meditation, what we find over time is that prayer can actually become delightful. That those 10 minutes that I was speaking about in the morning, over time, can be a precious joy to us. Of course, it won't always be that way, but we it's part of our rule as priests of the society that we're supposed to have 25 minutes of meditation each morning. So sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good.
Right.
But there's definitely over time, one feels that these meditations are a very precious time for deepening our relationship with God.
That's great. Those are very good guidelines and practical tips. I almost feel like I'm demeaning a prayer life by calling it a tip, but we need those, I think. So thank you for that. On to another question, which is somewhat similar and kind of in the same sort of sense. This was submitted by a father who wanted to know a little bit more about, you know, the best way to balance work and life. And again, there's no, you know, 5-step, 8-step, 12-step program here. And I know you can't provide a perfect answer for every situation, but speaking more in general guidelines, you know, for working dads, I know myself, I have children and I have a full-time job and other things and other duties. I often feel a sense of being pulled between my responsibilities to my family and my responsibilities to work, which is my duty of state. And there's often times where, you know, I have to work late into the evenings and that cuts into family time. And it's really hard. I mean, this was submitted by someone else, but I really related to this question myself. I have a hard time myself determining what's the best balance there. Is it really my duty to be working late into the evening, or should I be clocking out and maybe making less money or taking a lesser position in order to spend more time at home? I know it's a really loaded question. I know you can't really give a perfect answer for every situation and every dad or every parent, but what are some general guidelines in that sense?
Yeah, you're so right, Andrew, that there's no one size fits all solution here. And priests, when they advise fathers and mothers, generally what they do is just give the principles without dictating and telling them you need to do this or you need to do that in, as far as down to the last detail, because the parents themselves have to develop a certain prudence, even supernatural prudence, to know to be able to judge what is best for them and their family. Obviously, as you just said, the fathers have a duty to provide for their families. That is one of their primary duties. And sometimes in our current workaday world, that will demand them having to be away from home at irregular hours in order to put bread on the table. And I think it's a good point to make as well that for a man, it is important that he take a certain satisfaction from his work, that he attain a certain competence in his job, he pursue a certain quality of work, that he feels like he's doing his job well, that he likes his job, he is proud to a certain degree of the work that he's able to do. I think this is a sort of natural quality that God has put into man, that they are meant to work, they're meant to provide for their families, and it's all the better if they're able to take satisfaction from their work. But obviously, in the end, the job is only a means to an end. Mm-hmm. The family is the primary end. of a married man. And I think fathers always have to remember that really the success of their family is the success of their life. At the end of their days, they will be judged on how their family turned out. And so that's what they always have to look for. In other words, they have to always direct everything towards that end. Whatever decisions they make, they must see it in light of that final end. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's a great balance and a great touchstone to try and achieve is you know, keeping that in mind. That this is what you're going to be judged on, and yes, this is your duty of state for now, but at the end of the time, this is what you'll be judged on finally. So, no, I was just going to comment that was a great, you know, touchstone for us to, you know, really look at.
Yeah. So as long as the job remains a means to an end and not an end in itself, I think a husband can say things are in their proper order. As far as the home life goes, clearly the words of St. Paul to husbands are extremely important, where he says, "Husbands, love your wives."
Mm-hmm.
I think that men need to be told that that they have a duty to especially spend time with their wife and children. They have to sometimes even use the word "quote unquote" waste time. You know, just when we use the word "spend," I would say spend liberally. So what I mean is, especially when they're at home, to want to pass their time with their wife and their children, to take joy in being with their wife and children. I think husbands have to learn how to enjoy spending time with their family. They must try to make their time with their family delightful for themselves and for their children. And even though some husbands are perhaps irregularly at home, they are yet still able to be good fathers, because when they are home, the time that they are home, they are really able to create an atmosphere of joy, of mutual respect and trust. So if we think of an example of a husband who, when he comes home, he just is immediately interested in looking at the newspaper or watching a sports game or spending all his time on a computer, versus a husband who comes home and he spends his time perhaps playing with the children or assisting the wife in what she needs to do. Or who periodically takes his wife out to a restaurant. That's the sort of contrast I'm talking about. So if the husband, even if he's not able to be there all the time, if when he's there, he's showing this real effort to spend time with his wife and children, I think that's a very, very good sign.
Yeah, so when you're home, be at home. When you're present, be present. And when you're at work, be at work. I mean, I guess it comes down to being as simple as that, and the rest naturally falls into place.
Exactly.
That's great. Well, moving on from a couple questions about, you know, the spiritual life and you know, how to practice that in daily life. Moving on to another question about more doctrinal issues and more, you know, I guess more. What we talked about was more practical. This is more doctrinal. And it regards the current status of canonizations in the Catholic Church. I remember growing up, I had a little picture book, and it was about Blessed Kateri Tekakwitha. You know, I loved reading that book. I thought it was neat. And now she's a canonized saint. Many of the saints that we know about, you know, Padre Pio, for instance, and Maximilian Kolbe, I think he was canonized in 1982. They are likely, undoubtedly, if I could say, be so bold, they're in heaven, they are saints, but they went through the new rite of canonization, which the society has always viewed as troublesome, and not as complete as it has been throughout the tradition of the church, which is why You know, we can say that there are doubts about the canonizations of Paul VI and John the 23rd and John Paul II, etc. Where do you view the line there? The question was, why is it common to call Maximilian Kolbe Padre Pio Saints, yet not John Paul II or Mother Teresa? If someone comes to you, where do you draw the line as far as a veneration of these people, of these saints?
Clearly, the general principle as far as the society goes is that we have reasons to question these modern canonizations, as you've indicated. The primary reason is it's obvious that some of those who have been canonized have not really been models of the Catholic faith. You think about Jose Maria Escrivá or recently John Paul II. And even under Pope Francis, it seems like it's almost automatic that if you were a pope after the Second Vatican Council, you need to be canonized, no matter how you lived your life. I believe Paul VI is to be canonized in October when his pontificate. I just think, even for the unbiased observer, his pontificate was very troublesome. So this leads us to say, well, what's going on here? Because in the past, the common opinion of theologians was that canonization is an infallible act. It's connected to an exercise of the infallible magisterium. And so we say, how can this be? And generally, what the theologians of the society say, especially Father Calderon and Father Glaze, two teachers in our seminaries, one in Icon and one in La Reja in Argentina, what they say is, well, you know, those theologians who were making that judgment in the past, they were making that judgment on the basis of the canonization process as it existed in that time.
Right.
And that canonization process has been radically overhauled in this post-conciliar world. So there's been several decisions modifying the process of canonization, making it a lot less rigorous, a lot less serious. And effectively, where the judgment of the Pope is not exercised with the same circumspection as it was in the past. And because of that, we would say that, well, this modern process does not have that same note of infallibility. It's kind of ironic that I think even Pope Francis has said that, of course, my canonizations are not infallible. I believe this is something that I remember Bishop Lay saying that Pope Francis said this at some point. So we do, as a general principle, doubt the canonizations, but it's really the controversial canonizations that are most doubtful. The canonizations of Maximilian Kolbe or Padre Pio are not really controversial for us, as you indicated. I mean, obviously they lived very holy lives. They were exemplars of the Catholic faith. So it's not so controversial in those cases, and you may find some people, may find some of our faithful or some of our priests even referring to them as saints. And when they do so, I really don't think they're wanting to say that the modern canonizations are without any doubt. They're just wanting to express a certain respect for these people. Perhaps they're expressing their own opinion, as you just did, that these people deserve to be canonized as saints, without, of course, being able to pass judgment. But in the end, this is something that the Church will have to decide in the future, how to deal with these modern canonizations when the Church is restored. And meanwhile, I mean, this is the superiors of the Society of St. Pius X. They're not going to say to the priests and faithful, you must not ever use the word saint for any of these saints who are canonized after the council. I think that would be a bit draconian to say never call Maximilian Kolbe a saint or Padre Pio a saint.
Sure. And you know, it's kind of a shame in a sense Well, not kind of. It is a shame that, you know, in the missal that we follow in the Ordo being the, you know, the essentially the calendar, I guess you could describe it in a better way than I am, but, you know, that the priests use to say Mass and so forth. I mean, there are many new feasts and, you know, new saints who have been added that would be, you know, wonderful, I'm sure, to say the Mass of and to venerate, you know, in the liturgy, you know, like we've talked about. But, you know, the person who asked the question asked, you know, where's the consistency there? And I think that's where meaning the SSPX, can point to that consistency and say, well, we are being consistent in that, you know, we are using the 1962 missal, the 1962 Ordo, the calendar. But like you said, in personal venerations, or one of the priests may say, St. Padre Pio, sure. But that's not to say that it's, like you said, casting any doubts there.
Right. And, you know, we had an example here in Australia. I think it was back in 2013 when the first Australian saint was canonized by Benedict XVI. Perhaps it was before 2013, because I think he resigned in 2013. But anyway, she was a very great figure, Mother Mary of the Cross, Mary MacKillop. And it was a time of great expectation for the Australian faithful for them to have their first saint. And she was one of those canonizations where it was not controversial, because she really did live an exemplary life. And I believe that even here in Australia, the priests were given permission to say a Mass, celebrate a Mass. It's just like a votive Mass in her honor on the day of her canonization. So it's just an example of a canonization that's not so controversial. And so the superiors are not going to say, you must not show any honor to these saints, or you must not pretend that they are saints. It's okay in those cases to think that they're saints, or to think that they are worthy of the veneration of the altar.
Right. I mean, on a personal note, you know, growing up in Kansas, you know, Father Capon, some people say Father Capon, but he was a priest in, you know, from Wichita, and, you know, served in Korea, and was a chaplain, and, you know, by all measures, you know, like, you know, probably a saint, probably in heaven. His cause for canonization is up right now. I mean, I personally would love nothing more than to see him formally declared. But again, that's kind of one of the many tragedies of the time that we live in now, is that you have to, you know, I guess we can't fully celebrate or fully recognize, you know, his eventual canonization or any of the others because of just all of the doubts that are there. And it's really a shame. And like you said earlier, I hope it's rectified at some point in the future. We can all hope and pray for that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It is tragic to be in that state of uncertainty, that state of doubt. It shouldn't keep us from honoring those who truly deserve to be honored, but it does put us in a position where we can't say definitively, because we're not the church, what is the final answer on these disputed questions. I did just wanted to mention that it was kind of ironic in the case of Mother Mary of the Cross, because in her canonization, because I wrote an article about this in the Angelus, in fact, for me, she kind of resembled Archbishop Lefebvre, because she was excommunicated by her local ordinary.
Oh, wow.
She was excommunicated for basically not doing exactly what the bishop wanted. The bishop was on this power trip, and he was effectively asking her to break her own rule, to abandon her own rule, which she had vowed to observe before the altar of God. And of course, she couldn't do that. And when she effectively refused, she was excommunicated. But she knew that this excommunication was an abuse of power. She did receive it extremely humbly. And she just quietly went off to the side and waited for all the dust to settle. And eventually, you know, she was restored. But in the meantime, even though the bishop had supposedly excommunicated her, there were many priests who were willing to give her communion and treat her officially as not being excommunicated. And I just thought that was a very interesting parallel with the case of Archbishop Lefebvre, who was supposedly suspended and supposedly excommunicated and continued doing what he was doing because he knew that the excommunication was not proper. You can't get excommunicated for doing the right thing. The formality of the act loses its power if there's no proper reason for the excommunication.
Well, the ironies there are just delicious, not in a good way. But wow, that I need to read more about her. And thank you for letting me know that you wrote that article. We'll need to look that up, and we'll post a link to that as well on the description of this page here, so that more readers can take a look at it. But yeah, that's
great.
Amazing. Well, Father, I appreciate your time again today. Thank you so much for going through those questions. We have plenty more in the docket if you're still willing. And again, we'll be doing more talks with both Father Robinson and some of the other priests of the society as well as the days, months, weeks, years go by. So please feel free to continue sending in the questions. And Father, thank you again for agreeing to answer them. And we'll keep you busy, I'm sure.
It's my pleasure, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe and rate the podcast so that more people can hear the beauty and truth of traditional Catholicism. For more news, resources, and updates, you can visit the U.S. District website at sspx.org or the English news website of the Society at fsspx.news.